Connected live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
I said earlier to Gugu, we're going to have a full-on conversation about the state of education with really somebody who understands the sector very, very well. She's someone who's been around for a while and, as I said, is the one person to go to when it comes to basic education. Equal Education General Secretary is in studio with us, Nonqeto Matubedube. And I am going to be sort of sponging everything from you because there's a lot to go through. And I hate that we always talk about education only in January.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, let's do this differently. Yeah. Let's talk about it right now. And I do not want to talk about it just because matric results are coming out, because that seems to be our obsession. You know, we have this obsession with matric results. We don't talk about grade eights, grade nines, grade fives, for instance. Yeah. We only speak about grade fours, grade zeros, grade ones, and matrics. Mm. What's going on there? Why is there such an imbalance and inequality with regards to the kind of phases a student goes through during their schooling years?
Hmm. It's interesting that you started there, because I actually wanted to land from there. If we want to talk about the status of education, we need to start that conversation now, just as matrics have finished their last papers. Now, there's an imbalance. A few things can be hazarded by people across the sector at different levels or phases of the schooling system. The inequality, first to premise this, the inequality in the education system mirrors the inequality of the country. Mm-hmm. If we're the most unequal country in the world, then best believe that our education system is as unequal. The school community, if we were to use a political context to set a picture of what we talk about inequality, the school community is a direct mirror of the experience of a child every day in their schooling environment. Mm. So if you think about a school that is in the northern parts of KZN in Ngqutu, and their experience of water security, sanitation security, adequate classroom size and space, access to quality, what we call LTSMs, is a learning and teaching support materials. Mm. So have that picture in your mind and the kinds of distances they have to walk to school.
Yes.
And then think about a school in Rondebosch in Cape Town that is a public school, has an AstroTurf, a swimming pool, a designated gymnasium, psychosocial support on hand. LTSM isn't a worry. Their classrooms are buses. But all of these children and all of these people, including teaching staff and personnel, are part of the same public education system. Mm. So that's the story we're talking about here. Thinking about the different phases. Children, part of the reason Bella is so radical and transformative for us as a country, and people please listen to this very carefully, is because it is introducing this idea that schooling will be compulsory for children from grade R. Mm. What that means isn't just an inconvenience of numbers into the schooling system, okay? What that means is that the majority population, the kinds of children whose parents are dependent on the 350, will be able to experience traditional and proper and formal schooling a year earlier than they normally do. Mm-hmm. What we've picked up is that some of the challenges at the fourth grade level, where children in South Africa can't read for meaning at 81%, is because they're being left behind from the very beginning. Mm. And so grade R is one place to hit the spectrum. Mama Nomthunzi is coming out of an ECD. I provided that kind of care, graduating children into grade R, but that system isn't as a formal as a normal schooling environment. Okay. But I maybe am able to take my child to something that's like a Waldorf, I don't know, different kinds of experiential experiences there, resources, safety in the community. So the experience of a formal schooling entrance is very different. Mm. And then they graduate, they move up through the foundation phase. Then in grade three, they have to move very quickly, swap. I nearly said profanity. I have to just keep my mouth clean. As soon as they move out of grade three into grade four, they're suddenly switching languages, okay, and mediums of instruction. They get introduced to a language that they only probably hear on social media or television. And they are unable to progress. Some children live in an environment where that is their learned tongue. Context is related to children that are in sort of privileged environments. How assessments, how children are taught to decode language, phonics, all of it is based on what a very minority of students and pupils and learners and children are exposed to in the day-to-day lives. So that's the second phase. Grade R, and we can't all access it at the same time in the same ways. By the time we're finishing foundation phase, we're getting hit by the system, asking us of things that we can't contextualize. Okay? And then children move further out into the schooling system. By the time they hit early high school, grade 8, grade 9, grade 10 is a pinnacle point where they're choosing subjects. But at grade 9 already, you're losing children. There, the social wage conditions plus the fact that academically they've been left behind become an even more burden. It's now an intersectional compounded issue because those children are walking 6 kilometers to school one way. Those children don't have enough LTSMs. If you don't have a textbook to go home with that belongs to just you, you're not incentivized to learn at home. Right? Those children are in schools where sometimes you have to go home at 12 because there's no water or there's no food. The school nutrition program, I hope everyone that's listening can start thinking about the social wage conditions of being in school. The things that aren't you and your teacher and the mathematics and the school board as part and parcel of the right to education, especially in a country that is unequal as South Africa. If you don't have water and you don't have toilets, and you don't have food, it's difficult for a child to be inside the classroom. And then you have children in the East Rand of Gauteng here who will tell you that on average, there are 68 of them in every single classroom that they're in. So by the time that they're getting to grade 10, if the system isn't doing something, I want to call it extraordinary, but it's because of the way that we live. It should be just natural or normal that all schooling environments are conducive for learning. But if the school isn't able to give the kind of resources that keep a child enthused and engaged in a conducive, safe and dignified environment, they're likely to go find something else to do with their time. I mean, very recently this year, we had a massive stats about 4,000 learners had fallen pregnant between, I think it was October of last year and the period it was being reported.
Yeah,
I spoke to someone about this in this manner. I was like, yeah, but why are we still calling it pregnancy? Why not rape? And they said to me, no, but Nongado, you must also understand that the majority of these pregnancies are of similar age parenting. That means young people, even before they turn 18 and technically leave the schooling system, are idle. Now, that's a crisis. That's another level of schooling. Those that pass through grade 10 are able to find a subject of choice in their schooling environment, are able to feel like they can flourish in their schooling environment. Their teachers are working themselves to the bone beyond burnout. The school management teams are seeking justice and support from anything that will offer because the government simply isn't responsive sometimes. Make it to matric and they sit for an exam that they have not been prepared for in the same vein. I know maybe someone will call in here and say, look, MTN set up a what, and you can go on that site and press this QR code. That's not the same thing as an environment of schooling that allows you to get there in full flourish, that gives you all of the materials that are necessary to dignify you as a child. I mean, there are massive child protection laws across the world and in South Africa, but they're not incorporated or considered when thinking about the right to basic education, which to me is mind-blowing. You get to matric, you write your examination, you pass. How many of you are technically ever going to make it to a tertiary institution? I'm going to give you an example to everyone that's listening now. There's a new charter school model, so a form of privatization of the public education system that is rolling out in the Western Cape. 2 weeks ago, we were in the Western Cape in Worcester, visiting a school that's been converted into one of these charter school models. They call them collaboration schools. Now, what they preach about these collaboration schools is that they're going to be able to increase the quality of outcomes in children that are inside of these establishments. These public-private partnerships will ensure that private actors can come into the system and bridge the gap of the resources that the state simply can't get to the school with. Okay? On paper, sounds fine. This school says to us, the problem here, I mean, we'll talk about the various other problems that happen in the school, but the parents are sharing with us that 23% of the children that wrote the matric exam in the last year passed.
23?
Only 23%. That doesn't sound to me like a model that's encouraging an increase of outcomes, right? And of those 23%, the parent says there are only 3 that made it to a tertiary institution. This is one of 3 high schools in that community.
So what's going on there?
But this is the thing. So if you're going to introduce a public, anyone that's worked in health justice will share the story with you. Okay, there's the medical aid, we're chasing a forgotten, and quite frankly, no political will around a public health system. Mm. And a similar thing happens. It's like 101 of any kind of neoliberal government. Mm. We take a certain batch of schools, we go, high risk, need support, and we hand them over to the mercy of these private actors who aren't really accountable or regulated by anyone or anything. They run these interventions, they test out their things, they may or may not have any experience in education. Once they're done or the project's failing or the outcomes aren't what they expect, they fold their hands and they go, thanks. In the meanwhile, government has done nothing to really observe what's been happening in that environment. Mm. And so the school, the reason we're in contact with them is because they've been writing to the government and to us going, please, can you help these guys remember that we're here? They gave us partners who haven't done the job, but have in fact broken the schooling system in this community. One thing that I will never forget, it's a hot memory for me. One of the parents who appears to be on the SGB says to me, but what you must understand, Ndanam, here is that now we've got generations of children just lying in these streets. Drug abuse, premature pregnancies. It perpetuates such a deep inequality and poverty inside of our communities.
Just go back to these charter models and tell me, in a way, what actually happens there. These people come, of course, with their resources and agenda, but typically what actually happens? Where's the disconnect?
Okay, so this is how we found out about these instruments. Now, we were looking at an amendment of the provincial law location in the Western Cape.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were looking, folks said to us, our own researchers, guys, we found that there are two schools that have been added in the descriptions of ordinary public schools.
Mm-hmm.
And these are collaboration schools or donor-funded school.
Mm.
And we went, oh, okay. So we wrote to the department, hi, what are these things again? Mm. And how do they fall in line here?
Mm.
We wrote to the National Education Department too to go, does this not circumvent the laws between national and province?
Mm.
Do you know about these things and what are they?
Mm-hmm.
And as we tracked, they said, no, look, we're piloting a thing. We can't share any deep information with you right now. What we are doing though is because of the influx of people, the migration rates into the Western Cape, our budget simply can't hold all of the learners and people in the system. So we found partners to, in the short and medium term, support the schools that really need it. Those aren't performing as well, XYZ. We'll support with curriculum development, we'll support with monitoring and evaluating teachers, give teachers themselves mentorship and support, we'll support the school management teams. A myriad of things on offer depending on what the school needs, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a school in Ulanga that's gotten this kind of intervention. There's a school in Eastern Rifier that's gotten this kind of intervention, probably the better of the models. There's a school then in Worcester. They're slowly rolling out in Willowvale in the Eastern Cape as well. One day I welcome the folks in Willowvale to tell their story for themselves in the Eastern Cape around what these interventions can do. So it's various kinds of cocktails that they can offer on the school.
Mm.
The example I want to use is the school in Worcester.
Mm.
So because when you convert a school from ordinary to a collaboration schools, you'd have to consent from the environment, okay, the school community. So they run these consultations, the school agrees and goes, do need all of these various things. The private actor is then contracted and then joins the school.
Mm.
The first thing that they were proposing in these initial laws was that in the amendment of the provincial law is that these private actors will get a seat on the governing body.
Okay.
And that they are likely to get a majority vote on the governing body.
No way.
Now, anyone that's listening to this,
no way,
will understand democratization of South Africa was in many levels and layers.
Mm.
School governing bodies are a key part of a people's governance model for the basic education system. It is a protection of the children in that school to have the parents run a majority consensus on things and affect their own children.
The one seat gets a majority.
It's not one seat. It can be multiple, depending on the size of the school, size of the governing body. But they do, in fact,
want
get
a majority.
Majority.
No, that makes no sense.
The other thing they propose, they say, look, because it's the Western Cape, right?
Yeah.
A very violent province.
Mm.
I saw the other day that 14 children have already been killed in the Western Cape over a short period of time.
Yeah.
So they say, look, to make these kinds of interventions, we need to also make sure that we can build intervention facilities which will be able to extract troublesome children out of the system and take them into these institutions. So now we ask, what are these institutions?
Yes.
What are they offering?
What are they doing?
Now imagine if you think of something like a Boys Town, and please no digs or dabs on anyone that works at Boys Town or whatever it is, but those institutions haven't always been the most great rehabs for young people. In fact, from there, it almost feels like building a school to prison pipeline.
Mm.
And the questions we're asking, who's going to man these facilities? Mm. Where are the resources going to come from? What is the framework they're using for replication of young people? And the other thing is that once the child has completed their program, how do you then integrate them back into the schooling system without ostracizing them? Because that's what you've done.
Mm.
And so we haven't had answers to that kind of question. The third thing that we were concerned about is that they were proposing an independent evaluation of teachers.
Hmm.
Now, teachers are the backbone of any kind of school community.
Mm.
And what's important for us is that absolutely teachers need to be accountable to their jobs. It's jobs, it's jobs, it's jobs. Okay? An inspired, motivated, vibrant teaching changes the school environment completely and the experience of learners.
Mm.
But what we've been asking is that if you're going to think about ways to keep teachers accountable, it has to be a reciprocal accountability mechanism. Because part of the reason teachers are so burnt out and burdened is because the environments they work in are awful. So that's the third thing that was being introduced here. So every single time we've engaged the Western Cape Education Department, they've said to us, we've embargoed the M&E, so the monitoring and evaluation and learning sort of report of this pilot model, but they went on and implemented it at full scale. So they've got a couple of schools running now in the Western Cape. The Worcester School, I was using an example here, are one of the most recent schools that have pulled out of the model.
Hmm.
What they shared with us, the one example they used, which I thought was like a movie, we walked into the school at reception. There's a plaque there that says the school's got on a lab, a science lab donated by X Place.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to mention the name.
Mm-hmm.
And you go into the school, and one of the teachers takes us to said lab. It's vacant. In fact, it's got cobwebs. It's dusty. And they explained to us that they opened this.
Mm-hmm.
They invited media for the opening,
mm-hmm.
and they rented Bunsen burners and all of that kind of equipment.
Mm.
And there was a full-on photo op. The journalists left, the Bunsen burners followed them, and that was the last time that lab was operational in its truest sense.
Wow.
Now, if you are a government and you are struggling with creative ways to effectively use your fiscus to afford all children in South Africa the right to education, fine to look for partners that can support, but you have to hold them accountable. The problem with private actors that enter a public system is that they build a culture of government divesting its attention and resources to said area or school. And that's what we're seeing. And we're worried about the kinds of ills that could be experienced in those kinds of environments.
Mm.
This school I'm talking about, in 1 year, had subjects on the matric results statements of these children that they'd never done in school with marks allocated.
Mm.
They've got teachers in a high school, a secondary school, that are only qualified to be teaching in a primary school. It's an abomination. And so I'm sharing this to talk about what happens at different phases of the education system, but also if we aren't careful, and when I'm saying we, I'm literally talking to anyone that's listening to us now. The school nearest to where you operate, to live, where your parents are, where you work, is part of your own
responsibility
too. Please find out what the school needs, where they need support. Talk to the learners too. What is their experience of that environment, and how can those children be protected?
First.
And that responsibility for us isn't just about whether I'm able or allowed to deliver shoes to a school at the beginning of the year, but really trying to think about what is the district, the province, and national government doing to protect and safeguard the right to basic education, especially for the children most marginalized in our country. And that's all of our business.
Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I'll take your calls, your comments, your questions, 086-000-0959. You can also send a voice note on 063-688-0959. Is in studio with us. She's from Equal Education. She's the general secretary there. And very welcome for you to call in, ask questions, make your comments. We're speaking about the state of our education in this country. You know, Nongato, when we speak about education, oftentimes, hardly ever do we speak about a very marginalized community, the disabled, where it is so normal that children who are, let's say, using Braille books, it's normal for even schools right here in Rosebank for them to have one textbook for the entire class. This idea of them having a book to go and read and study themselves like all other children do does not exist. The government tells you, yes, we will. It has never happened. Blind SA has been advocating for this for yonks. But it's not only to your point earlier about everybody making it their business. It's not only the school or the government. Publishers themselves are not interested in providing books. It becomes such a commercial fight about the rights of children who have every right to learn, like any other child, for instance.
You know, I was watching something recently, and it was on the timeline. I was scrolling on something, and I read something that said, we shouldn't be trying to build a world where differently abled people can exist, but we should be trying to build a world for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Because at some point in your life, parts of your body, you will also become differently abled, mm-hmm. regardless of what the thing is and how it affects you.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, you're at such a granular level, that's going, into a world that feels safe. And I really think our education system suffers with that.
Mm.
Two things here that I could maybe hazard. No? One is that if our basic education system at a national level, never mind the provinces, is struggling to fully eradicate plain pet latrines. And now, you know, every time you hear this, people I'm sure think, yeah, I'm sure there are other toilets there. There are long drops as the only form of sanitation in schools. I'm not about ventilated, late in the community. Fair. Eradicate plain pit latrines, a very dangerous infrastructure in schools. The idea of being able to I'm worried that I don't even know if it can happen in the next 5 to 6 years in this term of the current minister's tenure. I'm worried because even when we think and hear about it in terms of its interventions on the DBE level, you don't hear about it as intrinsic in every department across the board. One division or one part or department or directorate, that's the word I'm looking for, of the DBE that's focusing on inclusive education and thinking about learning tools and supports for teachers and learners and so forth, but at a minuscule level. You know, recently we were visiting schools in KZN because they wanted to talk to us about water security, which accompanies the sanitation crisis. And in the schools that had probably bathrooms or toilets at about, 70% completion rate, we were seeing that there were schools that had all-access bathrooms too, with ramps and the right kind of infrastructure all around.
Mm.
But in the majority of those schools, all of those were locked, even though some were in use. And so we're asking the principals, some of them are used as storage, as a matter of fact. They've got piles of old books and textbooks in there. So we're asking school principals, why is it that this bathroom is not working? The principal goes, yes, but I don't have any different abled learners in the school.
And so
what happens is that this becomes a place where, I don't know, it's used for X, Y, Z, but we're using it for this purpose now because we need more space for this and that. So there's also a little bit of a crisis, and that's why I'm saying it's not intrinsic in all departments across the board.
Mm.
So you will then have a crisis around planning.
Mm.
And if you can't plan and map and understand exactly where these schools are and how to support them, they won't be considered in budgetary considerations.
Mm.
That's the second bit. I haven't heard government say, we're going to push, because this is the thing about equitable budgeting, which is a necessity in a democratic system. You have to think about those most marginalized or disenfranchised or ill-resourced. If you are doing that, there should be a far more amount of money and asks from the private sector in supporting the objectives of government to support inclusive education. And that's just not the case. During the COVID period, we were running around trying to make sure that we could get the school nutrition program opened for learners because children were food insecure.
Mm-hmm.
Whilst we were doing that, we then went into Mpumalanga to see some... We don't work in Mpumalanga, to see some schools in that area. We visited two special schools. And there were children there that were in a boarding establishment that might as well have been lying on the concrete that is supported by their beds because their mattresses had just diminished. But the kind of budget allocated to the maintenance of those kinds of schools is next to nothing. And when it is, and you haven't found a good contractor, the supply chain is broken down somewhere, there aren't remedies to concentrate on making sure that thing is resolved. So money gets sent back from rural provinces and those schools just get further and further left behind. and you don't have strong associations outside of Blind SA, for example, that are really thinking about not just plain advocacy, but we need strong people-led civic movements to really represent the rights of children in our society.
There is a major disconnect to your point about the rights of children, where you almost, and I hear this a lot, it makes me very uncomfortable, where you would hear a politician who almost wants to punish a community through children, where they say, well, that infrastructure or that building of a school was corrupted by, I don't know, X, Y, Z, therefore we are going to abandon it. Forgetting the children in the school have nothing to do with the dispute that was there between the contractor and whoever it is. It happens a lot where there has been corruption in the school or the SGB or the principal has done something and the department abandons the school, forgetting that you can actually hold people accountable and not abandon the children themselves.
You know, we've been arguing a lot with the super ministry. And when I say the super ministry, I hope listeners are hearing me talk about the National Treasury, because they seem to determine their own priorities. What the super ministry has started doing at the very beginning of each year, so we've mentioned at least that sometimes rural provinces take back their budget allocations at the beginning of each year without having done things in province. So what's happened now is that the super ministry has gone, okay, I'll take back this money and then I'll reallocate it to provinces that I know will be able to spend it in good time. And the argument we've been making to Treasury, and I mean, well, we're talking maybe now a response from a district office or provincial department. I'm talking at a very national level.
Yeah.
The behavior and mechanism, I was recently listening to Mampemi of the water department talking about how these municipalities haven't paid water, therefore we cut the water. I'm thinking, yeah, but what about the people? Mm. Okay? So what the ministry, the Treasury is doing now is that they're reallocating these funds. They're going, look, we're using a regulation inside of our own laws. And we've been making the argument that whilst it's, we hear you, you're taking money away from Limpopo because they haven't been able to spend it. But these children then still go to schools that don't have toilets, water. And then, in fact, then can't feed children as a result of missing these things.
The need is still there.
And so I do think our government has a very paternalistic relationship to people, first of all. And then it's compounded on children. I mean, anywhere where children go, this is part of the work of Equal Education, is this idea of supporting an active civic youth that is at the forefront of their own system. They'll be able to tell you best how their schools operate and could work best for them. But the same children and young folks we work with are typically spoken down to or on behalf of in their community, in their homes, in church, by government. And so in the model of how we're trying to work and engage government and treasury, we're continuously talking about that the relationship of being too paternalistic and determining things for people does in fact hurt them in the long run. And so a big part of our argument to National Treasury is always that whilst you make this provision and you think you're being cunning and or using money effectively and efficiently, and I'm sure the Western Cape appreciates those injections every year, what you are doing is further disenfranchising those in the poorest parts of the northern parts of Limpopo, KZN, Mpumalanga, and so forth. And our deep concern with this kind of approach is that we've never heard any MEC contest that. And we're yet to see if the new Minister of Basic Education nationally will ever call the National Treasury out for that kind of behavior. Because what we should be focusing on is supporting effective and efficient expenditure across departments inside of the education system. And part and parcel of doing that work, unfortunately, for the ministers, for all MECs, is working hand in hand with general society, working hand in hand with people, with civil society. Gone are the days, truly, we don't even have a majority government anymore. Gone are the days of political parties finding civil society and social justice movements as being antagonistic. I think what we really deserve now is to see if we can't give ourselves a fighting chance over the next 5 years and radically improving the conditions of the most marginalized.
Just talk to me a little bit about what I'm seeing. I mean, I could be completely wrong. I'm hearing and seeing a culture of, for instance, we now talk a lot about security at schools, right? So you're hearing in certain schools where there are problematic issues, there's added security, and there's a little bit of a move towards that. Hardly am I hearing about the addition to maybe a sports ground or an arts and culture kind of facility to deal with the issue at its core, because when you speak to those communities, they will tell you, our children are idle, our children have nothing to do, we have no sporting facilities, we have nothing for them to do. And so this, what I would think is a short-term measure, for me, makes me uncomfortable, but perhaps it's necessary.
So from the times of Angie Motshekga, a big part of the work we've been doing as civil society is almost trying to convince or cajole government into understanding that the right to basic education goes beyond the experience of the chalkboard and chalk with the teacher. It's all of these other things that you experience in that, inside of a schooling environment. And the reason I'm mentioning this is because if you're talking to the Minister of Education, they'll tell you that their priorities are around what happens inside of the classroom or in school. So when we're talking to them about infrastructure, for example, they say, yeah, but we must give that thing off to the Public Works Department. And we're going, yeah, but there has to be some ministry that compels others to work together with them to get the thing done. And it's your right to provide the right to education. In the last couple of years of advocacy, what has happened through the sector's work is that we've built jurisprudence around the right to education. Now the right to education is connected to the right to nutrition for children as a result of the intervention of the school nutrition program during the COVID period. Now the right to education is intrinsic to the right to transport, to scholar transport, as a result of the EE's victory in KZN during this period. The right to adequate school infrastructure, to textbooks, is a result of those initial interventions by Section 27 that compelled the minister to make these provisions. So without someone thinking about the extra mural, the school, the playground, the school community, libraries, Gosiam, as a key part of the basics of creating a conducive learning environment, we're going to keep hitting up against a government that goes, no, 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 our priority is just to make sure there's a teacher there, the curriculum is set, and children are inside of those desks.
So this may sound like a question that's not supposed to be meant for you, but I think it's important. We do now have monitoring and evaluation department within the presidency. Isn't that their role?
The amount of times we've written submissions to the DPME asking for them to make interventions. Part of the reason we did this is because we felt like National Treasury was running its own game. And we wanted some kind of subsidiary department that comes out of the presidency to almost watch and safeguard this right to basic education, to compel the Ministry of Education plus National Treasury to do the very right thing. But they'll tell you about capacity constraints.
You mean that very department?
Exactly. The DPME will tell you about capacity constraints. They'll tell you that they're doing their very best to support the National Treasury and they're watching the work of the department and they agree there should be improvements there. But I haven't seen any political will come out of that institution that truly holds accountable the National Treasury plus the Department of Basic Education. One of the things, and anyone that comes onto the show and that can talk about their work in our sector and civil society and in connection to interventions to support the government, will tell you one of the most difficult things to do in any kind of advocacy approach is getting government to commit to an interministerial coordination program.
I have sent people your way, in fact, I think, where you would have incompetent municipalities affecting the work of poor schools, where there isn't proper billing, for instance, how those little things affect, you know, the proper running of a school, where there are fights about lights and water and so on. And it is incompetency. It's got nothing to do with whether the school is run properly. Yeah. It's that a municipality is unable to run its things in order and denying communities the right to water, to electricity, and so on. And that cycle being so long that you just think, who is asking the question, how does that affect a school which can prove to you that it's done the right thing by its children and it's sticking to paying their bills, but nobody seems to care and is not doing their bit?
And I think that compounds those experiences for school principals that we've interacted with, especially in rural provinces, will tell you that whilst they've been in a long battle with municipalities, I mean, I've heard principals say, I'm at this point using my own money to just go buy water for these children. In schools in KZN, children are being asked to come to school with their own 5 liters of water. That's how bad things have gotten in some communities. But what also compounds that issue as well is that even if you can afford it, Maybe it's still broken from the municipal level. And I don't know if you can adequately get, I mean, the calls we've gotten are principals saying, I've been writing to the district office.
Yes,
I've been writing to province.
Usually that's what they say.
But principals are also saying to us, please, can you come again? I've got many letters here for you to reference because I need your help. Because when, so for instance, now we've gotten a 1.4 billion rand cut to the education budget from the midterm budget. When that trickles down to provinces and eventually to districts, principals aren't engaged on those cuts.
Mm.
You just see that in your school account, you've gotten less than you normally would.
Mm.
So I've spoken to a principal who's going, I mean, and the, his office was very busy also, tiny little prefab office, very busy, teachers walking in and out. He goes, the reason it feels like this here and there are papers everywhere is because our printer's broken, so we've only got this small one. But with the money that's come in, I need to think about, do these kids go to the singing competition using that taxi? Can we afford the transport? If not, can I take some of that money and monitor and maintain the bathrooms in X block for those boys? Or do I use it to fix this copier machine? And or do I take back what I took from the school nutrition program last month? These are the impossible choices that principals that are leading and school management teams and school governing bodies, of course, that are leading schools in the quintal 1 to 3 parts of our sector.
Yeah.
And when I keep reiterating this idea of extremely marginalized, maybe let me call them ill-resourced school communities, I'm talking about those that are no fee paying.
Yep.
Parents typically depend on that 350 to keep things going through the month. And so that kind of extra provision or subsidy that supports a school being able to make, it's not even nice to have. I mean, having a copy at a school so that you can get a printout, it truly shouldn't be like an incredible feat. Making sure that our classrooms have projectors, have resources that teachers can use to help children take home some work, you know? If you don't have enough textbooks, though. Those things shouldn't be nice to haves. Never mind working libraries and labs and adequate schooling or sporting facilities. So all I'm trying to say is that when we're looking at the education system, I'll come here and talk about the systemic things, right? The 1.4 billion rands, XYZ. But the ripple effect inside of the schooling environments is that principals and school governing bodies are having to make hard choices against the very bare necessities of what keeps the school going. So every time I'm speaking to folks that are listening and going, please go find your school, it's also because I'm wondering how else can we be supporting these institutions?
Mm.
But we must always join hands in holding our governments accountable.
Mm.
And so we must continue to look at the big systemic things. Because the other thing is that I suppose that we haven't talked about today is that people should know is that the education budget has been decreasing in real terms consistently over the last 11 years. Now, that's a crisis, okay? Because how you map a political priority is by looking at its funding stream too. So if our government is divesting in public education and the system is getting more and more fickle and volatile as our communities, then we truly have a big job ahead of us.
So in the coming year, you have already announcements about the fact that there will be fewer teachers in some schools. The school nutrition programs is likely to go in some schools. It's just a lot. Does it feel like we're regressing?
I'm an optimist of note. I mean, the only reason I do this work is because I truly believe in our lifetime we can change things around. But when you look at things in black and white, it does feel like an absolute regression. So we've got 2,400 teachers in one province that we know of, at least, that are being retrenched in the next year.
Mm-hmm.
On Friday, a few of our members went and presented to that provincial legislature to talk about this idea that having these teachers leave the system, in fact, infringes on the right to basic education of these learners. And what we were doing there, you know, when people say we've got a really vibrant and a working democracy in technical terms, you really want to hope that that's true. But truly, I think sometimes just a middle-class person can make that claim freely and then go to bed. Because what happens is that when you do eventually get access to a space like a provincial legislature, and you can then go present the realities of children in that environment or that area, what happened on Friday is that this province still adopted the provincial budget being proposed, regardless of these kinds of testimonials.
Mm.
And at that legislature meeting in particular, there were only two civil groups, NGOs, whatever you'd call them, that were presenting on behalf of the general public. The rest were just parliamentarians, and they simply accepted. So the other thing that I think South Africans must understand is that we have a very weak opposition in South Africa at the moment. The majority of our parties have joined the GNU, which in itself is a conglomerate of quite a, frankly, very different types of political parties. They've set up a task team to deal with the contentions and their policy differences that only contain political parties. They don't have any ordinary people there, even if it's an, as an observer status, to go, that policy is useful because of this reason. The people in the GNU themselves, some have not governed. And then even worse in our so-called opposition. And so truly, our legislative spaces, our National Assembly spaces, normal parliament procedures and protocols and channels are starting to feel incredibly weak too. So when you ask me, are we regressing? I truly think that. And this is, for me, feels like a moment where we don't just need civil society. We need all of us. All of us that are listening to these conversations, that are live, that have cousins, that are one sibling away from this kind of experience, where your own child will be in a school where you can't control the kinds of resources that they receive, need to start acting together now. We need to get government to reprioritize social goods, basic education being most important, because then we can create generations of excited, holistically groomed and grown individuals that are conscious and understand and can comprehend text and can build stories and make things. Goddamn, we deserve it.
Nonledo, thank you. Thank you for leaving us with a lot to think about. Thank you very much. I'm not feeling very optimistic, but you have given us a lot to think about, so we appreciate that. Equal Education General Secretary Nonledo Matubedube, thank you so much for your time.
If you missed it live, catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.